Okay, let's start. So, all right, welcome to our weekly meeting. I'm Pascal, for those who don't know me. I want to start the briefing tonight just by actually reading a quote from the latest paper that LaRouche has written on the subject of physical economy. The title is A New World Credit System, The Question Before Us. I think that's going to set pretty much the environment for what we're going to be discussing tonight. Brigitte, you have to do that right now? Okay. But just to give you a sense afterward of the latest development around the world. So I'll just read that and we'll go on. So that's a paper which was completed on Saturday, last Saturday. It says, the question addressed by the following presentation is, what are to be recommended for consideration as perspectives for what is a truly urgently needed four-power initiative on behalf of a mission-oriented process of transformation of the world's economic system away from the presently ruinous effects of submission to an implicitly financially imperialist global monetarist system, a virtual new Tower of Babel, yeah, and toward an urgently needed fixed exchange rate credit system of mutually beneficial global cooperation among peoples organized as a community of respectively sovereign nation states. This presumes the indispensable included practical measure of the included immediate application of the precedent provided as the principle of the Glass-Steagall reform, which was introduced to the USA under US President Franklin Roosevelt, which also means, once more, the eradication of intrinsically pro-imperialist monetary systems by the replacement by a system of sovereign national credit systems configured in the formation of a long-term fixed exchange rate array of national credit systems. All right, so that sounds like a plan. Y'all follow that? Pretty much. You want a summary? Okay. I'll give you my copy after. But this is basically, like, in a few sentences, that's the LaRouche plan, which we've been mobilizing on for the last months. And we've seen what we have to see right now in the configuration of the different events occurring right now internationally is that the world has shifted from an Atlantic-based, you could say, system to an orientation towards the development of the Pacific. And we've seen that, if you remember, in December, when China and Russia and Russia and India signed agreements, but not just to exchange raw materials, but to exchange technology. And that's part of the shift which was launched while LaRouche was pretty central in this conference in Rhodes, Greece, which happened the week before the agreement between Russia and China. So that happened, you know, at the end of 2009. And then what we saw also afterward, at the end of 2009, was the failure of Copenhagen, which pissed off a lot the Queen. But that's the world that we're living in right now. And so we have to take that into account if we want to understand the interventions that are being made, not just by Republican forces around the world, but also by the British Empire, the forces of the oligarchy. So starting from that, a bit more proof of how how the world has changed, going from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Well, as I just said, nations like China, India, and Russia in Asia want to develop. And what we're looking at, you know, is as there's, you know, it's cold right now. Oranges are freezing in Florida. You have, you know, a wave of just, you know, it's very cold. And, you know, well, we've been calling, you know, that an ice age was coming, was more probable than a warming, a global warming age. So the issue is, at the same time as this is happening, you have different moves, you know, made in different countries. And just to see how the European countries are not, you know, up to date on this question, France and Germany, as you know, they have record snow in France. They decided that they would actually subsidize the windmill. They actually, what's going on is that from nuclear power, you can get for the difference is 55 cents per kilowatt hour. And but France decided that, you know, unlike other countries like China, they would go for windmills. You know, and nuclear power is 3 cents per kilowatt hour, and windmill is 58 cents. That's your cost. That's what it costs to produce the kilowatt per hour. So France decided, okay, we're gonna go for that. That sounds good. And Germany says, well, since we shut down our nuclear facilities, they went for solar at the beginning, and now they're saying, well, now it's time to shift to windmill. Well, so at the same time, you have China, which is calling for having CANDU reactors. They're actually asking for Canadian technology to have more nuclear reactors to be able to develop. And you had a letter which was signed by 224 scientists. You had teachers also into this, nuclear scientists, other kind of physicists. That letter was sent to John Holdren, which is not necessarily a good guy, but you know, which is the science czar for Obama. And these guys are saying, we need, the world is going nuclear. We need to do it. You know, China, India, Russia, South Africa, everybody's going nuclear, even in the United Arab Emirates. They're saying, we need to keep, you know, be up to par, because we're falling, we're backwards right now. So they sent a letter and they said, we, you know, we have only one reactor that's on the schedule to be built in the next, I don't remember how long, what's the, but only one. So they're saying that's, you know, we're not, we're falling behind.
Sorry, who was that? Where
was it? That was a letter sent by 224 nuclear physicists, different kind of scientists, also teachers, well, I think three teachers, to John Holdren, the science czar for Obama.
Okay.
So they're saying we're falling behind, so we need to keep it up. at the same time, so that's to give you a sense of the Atlantic versus Pacific orientation. At the same time, if we look a bit at what's coming out, maybe you heard about AIG, maybe, no? The big insurance company that was bailed out and is now owned by the American people. Well, since they were bailed out, actually some money, 1.1, I think it was billion, came through for Bank of Montreal. But since they were bailed out by the U.S. government, AIG kind of transformed itself into a hedge fund. So they decided that they would reinsure the different banks, the different operations which they had, like the SEC, which is
security.
Yeah, that's it. Was evaluating, or the market was just saying, you know, these toxic assets that you have, the CDOs, CDS, everything of that sort, is probably around 8 to 20 cents, you know, from the value before when you bought it. You know, it's probably now from 8 to 20 cents to one, to the dollar, you know.
You're saying that if you bought it for a dollar, it's now worth 8 cents?
Now it's 8 to 20 cents.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, but when AIG was bailed out, what they did is that, you know, the market says something, you know, the wisdom of the market. But they decided that they would repay in full that they would insure in full these losses by banks, by hedge funds, by whoever had taken insurance from them. So they reinsured them, and they actually, with the money, they just kept the bubble up. So right now there is investigation coming out to see, well, what happened with AIG, because at the time when the bailout occurred, it was mainly done by people like Timothy Geithner, who's now the Treasury Secretary. And as he was working for the New York Federal, the Fed in New York. And so there's, I'm forgetting the names right now, but Eliot Spitzer, the former New York governor, has been calling for he's been calling to have all emails and documents related to AIG and the New York Fed released from the last 10 years. He just called for that last week, and he had made an initial call on the 25th of Christmas. Just before Christmas, he had called for that also to investigate AIG and know what actually occurred. Because it's, you know, it's not just one fraud, but it's like a double fraud. So there's Eliot Spitzer. There's also a congressman. I didn't get the name tonight. I missed it. But there's more than one that are calling for that to be released publicly, and they kind of have a good point. Like, I mean, they kind of have the point to do it, because now it's owned by the American people, so...
They want to know.
It's a good reason, you know, it's... There's
usually
no,
when you're private, you don't have to show...
Well, they say that it's... Yeah, because they say it's the internal affairs, you don't want to, you know, as we say, you know, the market, you know, you never know what's going to happen, spying, whatever. But it's right now it's public. It's owned by the American people, so there's no reason to keep it in. Just to say that for sure, LaRouche said, you know, let's go with it. Let's do it. Let's, you know, have these emails released. But everything that falls short from reestablishing the Glass-Steagall Act, that's not going to be good news. We need to actually go at these guys who did you know, gamble the pension funds. You know, we did just screw everybody over. We need to guard these guys like it's the Pecora Commission and reinforce the Glass-Steagall Act as it was under Franklin Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. So that's actually why I read the starting of Lynn's paper. Mm-hmm. But to be able to do that and to initiate at the same time, because you have countries in Asia, China, Russia, India, that are actually very much ready for a new system. But there's a block. We need also the United States to get in. You know, some people just, they talk about Brazil, but it's not the BRIC countries that are going to do it. You need Russia, China, India, and the United States. And other countries will join also. But the United States is very, very important. Yes, you have a question.
Yeah. You spoke of the Glass-Steagall Act. Can you explain briefly what that was exactly?
Yeah. Sorry. Under the Glass-Steagall Act, what you had was basically, it was part of many legislations which were put in during the New Deal era. And basically what it would do is tell, you know, this idea of transparency. Just say, well, you have a bank. You're, let's say, the owner of a bank, and you want to help small, medium enterprises. You know, you want to give loans to them. That's commercial banking. So we'll give you a charter, and you'll be a commercial bank. Now, you know, let's say your friend wants to open a bank also, but he doesn't. You know, he's more about making wild bets. So that's called investment bank. And you have other people will want to make insurance, you know, insure people for accidents, different things. That's an insurance company. If you decide that you want to be all three at the same time, you know, and become like a monopoly on these things, that's not legal. Under Glass-Steagall, you can't do that. You got to be either a commercial bank, you'll have a charter for this, or an investment bank, or an insurance company. You can't be the three at once.
So the Glass-Steagall Act applied specifically to banks or to monopolies in general?
Especially to banks.
Okay.
Especially for banks, yeah. Well, it was kind of a antitrust legislation.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the key is to protect the essential charter banking system.
You can
protect people's deposits from being used for investments, or I think probably
yeah.
to protect the insurance also from being gambled away too.
Yeah, sure. Because if you don't have kind of firewalls to say, well, this, you know, this is somebody's earning that he decided to save in the bank, so you don't take his money and gamble with it, you know. That was part of the act. And also what it would actually help us to do today is that you would be able to say, well, open the books and let us see what you did with the money. You know, you're chartered as, let's say, a commercial bank. Well, what kind of, did you do commercial activities, or was it, you know, wild speculation into offshore, you know, hedge funds? So you just get things cleaned up, and that obviously will have a radiating effect throughout the world. But from this, is it that's clearer now?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Here's
so the
should we add
sorry.
Just one last thing? That
go ahead.
That also within this there was a standard within the Glass-Steagall for what debt constituted an actual legitimate valuable debt, and what type of debt was actually something which is completely worthless. You know, there's a big difference between a debt that's tied to a mortgage, which has some physical value, and a debt that is actually really just a bet or a speculative debt, where you put money somewhere thinking that you there's a chance you can earn like 10% per month,
yeah.
But actually things changed and but there's actually nothing physical behind putting your money there. You're putting your money there on speculation. So within the context of the massive amounts of claims on the system right now, where you have 1.4 billion quadrillion you know, dollars worth of claims on the system within an economy that is, you know, several orders of magnitude smaller, the assumption, I think, properly is that most of that debt is actually fictitious and doesn't have any real value. And so Glass-Steagall
would be the
way that you could, you know, clearly define when you go in which debts will be protected and secured and, you know, and honored, and which ones will actually just be put aside until they can be sorted through.
Mm-hmm.
And just to clear up this one last thing, for every every physical thing, you could only have one contracted debt as that as collateral, for example, or?
Mm.
Oh, yeah, right.
You can't file a debt upon another debt?
Yeah.
So that's all that is.
Good. All right. So, but that's interesting, this AIG thing, because that actually leads us into also the whole question of the healthcare debate, or there's not much debate, but the intention behind the healthcare bill, and how it can be destroyed, it must be destroyed. So the AIG was an insurance you know, company, which was also doing deals with HMOs, because they are the providers for healthcare. So that ties in all of these things. So you have Timothy Geithner, which is, well, and Ben Bernanke, which are in the center of this whole thing. So that's a good thing. We don't know yet what's going to happen, but it's promising. So to go more into the, maybe not just the healthcare, but recently what happened is that you know, we didn't decide to run an impeachment campaign on Obama, but we decided to tell people that it's, you know, due to happen. It's, or that Obama is now emerits to get impeached. And just to give an idea to people, it's going to be on the next EIR if it's not already. But we've put four counts for which Obama should be impeached. So the first count, anyway, I'll develop them after. So the first count is conspiracy to commit crimes against humanity. Second count, conspiracy to violate the separation of powers provisions of the U.S. Constitution. Third, conspiracy to commit the United States to an international genocide policy. And fourth, conspiracy to destroy the sovereignty of the United States. So that's
big.
You know, yeah, pretty big count. So, and each you know, in themselves would be enough, but we have four. So the first one is directly tied to the healthcare policy. You know, under the NICE program, which is imported from the UK. Well, basically, this idea of crime against humanity is that you're actually denying care. And I don't know if people read much about the trial in Nuremberg, but that was one of the factors taken into account. That, you know, yes, you had torture, you had forced labor, you had gas chambers, but you also had denial of treatment, or no surgery, no medical attention, and that's a crime against humanity. So that's exactly what the NICE program does already in the UK. And Obama is committed to make it happen in the United States. So that's for the first count. The second count is basically tied into the first one, because the conspiracy to violate the separation of powers, that's a provision in the U.S. Constitution, applies to the healthcare bill, where you have the IMAB, maybe you remember that, the Independent Medicare Advisory Board, which was council IMAG before. But this IMAB is basically what we called the T4, the Hitler T4 in 1939. And this idea of the separation of powers is that in the ruling, in the healthcare bill, what they did is they introduced a clause which says that for the rest of eternity, we will have this law as a principle, a universal principle. So it won't be able to change at all. And also no Congress, no Senate will be able to vote any rules or any laws that will go against it or that would change it. So that's actually not legal, not just in the United States, but it's not. there's no way that you could actually do that in reality. But these guys are actually, they are. How would you say that? They're bully enough, or they really want to assert their will.
They won't have the word of God.
Yeah, kind of. So they said it's a perpetuity clause and it's above Congress. You won't be able to do anything about it forever.
That's kind of a bit unconstitutional though, right?
that's the whole thing. Yeah. That's why Obama should be impeached for this.
Yeah, like even the Constitution could have amendments.
Yeah.
How can you put something there that's unamendable?
Yeah.
That's exactly the point.
Yeah, exactly.
So because that's also,
you know, we have
a precedent. Sorry, what?
You're allowed to have surgery, just as long as you don't remove that bullet from your chest.
But that's also, if you look at, you know, what happened in the 30s in Germany, that's exactly how they actually got. They overthrew the constitution, the Weimar Republic. They overthrew it, and they said, well, now it's going to be an under emergency situation. It's going to be the executive, meaning Hitler, that's going to make the laws. It's not going to be the parliament assembled. It's not going to be a senate or a council, but it's going to be the executive.
Unitary.
And they called it the unitary executive. Mm. So that's the second count. That's why Obama should be impeached.
Sorry, so what exactly is this a part of the, like a clause of the bill that's being voted on right now in Congress?
They voted on it on the 24th of December. While everybody was partying, they voted upon it. The Senate.
Well,
now
the
what
Senate
they're doing right now, it hasn't passed, you're right. It's not concluded,
yeah.
But the issue is that they passed it in the Senate, you know, anyway. That they were, you know, that they really wanted to make it happen as fast as possible. And they did it on the 24th of December. Now what they have to do is put the two laws which were voted, one in the Congress and one in the Senate. They have to put them together and see, you know, how they can make one out of these two and vote it again.
Sorry, just one question. When the Senate inserts a law into a bill, does it have to go back to the lower house to be voted again, or does it stay in the Senate?
If it's not the same law, it has to be brought back to the Congress.
Okay.
Whenever you add something, it has to be voted upon.
Mm, okay.
So if it's or if they can arrange to have one, you know, if they can arrange to have a version in the House and a version in the Senate, which is the same, they can just vote it and that's it. But yeah,
so
it has to go back and be, after that, it's signed by the president.
So the first voting was in the Congress, right?
Yeah.
And this did not contain the IMAB legislation.
That's the thing, yeah.
Right? And then in the Senate, Harry Reid slipped it in.
Yeah.
And they voted it through in the Senate with the IMAB legislation,
mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
It's called the IMAB.
Yeah.
International, yeah.
Independent Medicare Advisory Board.
Okay. Thank you.
So the third count is conspiracy to commit the United States to an international genocide policy. Pretty big too. So that's concerning the Copenhagen summit. Well, the fact that already before Obama actually went to Copenhagen, he was told by senators that first the United States didn't ratify Kyoto. So they said, you know, that's not going to work too. And but Obama went on and he decided to commit the United States to it, to reduction of carbon dioxide, reduction of population, basically. So that was actually, and the whole thing is to see from the angle that actually these policies are not coming from the United States, but are being pushed upon the United States. The NICE is a creation from Tony Blair. So it pretty much all emanates from the sewers of the City of London or the Buckingham Palace. And so the Senate and the Congress had not passed these rules, these laws on, you know, the carbon emissions and all that. They said, forget it. You can't sign. The president has no right to sign any international agreement without the consent of the Senate, the voting of the Senate. So that's very important. But Obama decided, well, I'm just going to go with it. And so that's another, that's also unconstitutional. And fourth, there's no question. Fourth,
actually,
you have it,
sorry.
One? That's okay.
Well, so he never actually signed anything, though, because nothing came out of Copenhagen, right?
Yeah, well, it's to our benefit, but how do you say, hopefully
he was trying to
China.
Get something with Gordon Brown. They were
yeah,
working
yeah.
to get it. It was China that
well,
stopped.
Yeah, hopefully China. That's the thing. China,
well.
Russia, and India, and other countries were meeting together. And Obama was running around trying to find them. And they wouldn't meet with him.
They were already in the underpants in the hotel.
Oh, he was searching everywhere. But they wouldn't meet with him. Because they realized, you know, he's not, you know, there's nothing for the developing countries. Also, African countries decided to ally with China. And that was also previously to the Copenhagen summit. But yeah, that's pretty blatant.
Wasn't there also an incident where he actually barged in on a meeting between two other countries?
It was China, Russia, or China, India, and
Brazil.
Yeah, where he he went in the meeting. They said, "Well, we don't have a chair for you." He said, forget it, you know, don't worry about it. He went and get a chair and sat, but he was not part of the meeting. He was just there to listen, you know. He tried to get, you know, as close as possible, but China said, no, forget it, we're not.
Why that victory is as big as the victory on the American Revolutionary War?
Oh, yeah, well.
Why?
That's true. Lynn said it's a big victory. It's the biggest victory against the empire since the American Revolution. So you said that, why? Because of, well, because mostly of the four powers agreement, the intention to bring it, you know, to create it, and also the fact that, you know, we were, I mean, if these countries like China, Russia and India, and not stood up, I mean, the African countries, what would they have done, you know? So the fact that they stood up and actually said, we're gonna fight for development, and, you know, we're gonna stick together. It's not just a question of me, you, you know, we're friends. No, that's, it's, it was, I think, a higher purpose. But I think it's from that standpoint of, you know, groups of patriots that are now forming and reacting to the mad policies of the British Empire and saying, you know what, we don't want it anymore. We're not going to be part of it. That's enough. That's why you gotta. It's a great victory.
Which Venezuela play Hugo Chavez in this deal?
He was silent, I think. No. I didn't hear about him in the Copenhagen.
Well, he attacked
did
once.
Did he say something?
He kept his powers.
Okay.
It was, he attacked the whole summit.
Oh, yeah.
He attacked the whole summit. Okay. That's, yeah, I didn't hear much about him during that time. Anyway, every question?
I don't know if this is appropriate for this time, but can you explain how the Copenhagen summit, or the agreement that was trying to be reached at the Copenhagen summit amounts to genocide, international genocide?
Okay, well, should
gas.
I go it right now? Well, yeah, I mean,
that's probably more.
This whole thing, take it from the standpoint, what they wanted to create there was an international agency which would control carbon emissions all around the planet. Now the issue is carbon emissions, you know, there's nothing more natural than carbon emissions. So what are you really targeting when you say you want to reduce these carbon emissions? You're targeting industries, you're targeting human development, and obviously national sovereignty, because you say, well, you produce too much, you're going to have to pay us, a tax, you're going to have to shut it down. So that's how, in a sneaky way, if you actually decide to go with it, maybe you don't see it coming, but it's going to destroy your whole nation. So that's the purpose. These guys, you know, the Prince Philip, Prince Charles, all these guys are big greenies. But they stated it explicitly that they want to see the population of the world go from 6 billion to probably less than 2, around 2.
Where or when did they state that?
They stated that, I mean, if you look at
Prince Philip said he wants to be reincarnated as a deadly virus to wipe out humanity.
That was in one interview on Argentour, 1988.
Henry Kissinger's Limits to Growth, the Club of Rome.
That's where you
Henry
read the
Kissinger's
quote.
NSSM 200.
Right, that's one thing too.
Yeah, you've got a bounty of resources.
There's,
to find where,
I can, we can
yeah.
fill you
well,
in.
So
we can fill you in afterward.
One interesting place to check is the World Wildlife Fund Living Planet Report.
Oh yeah, that's good.
Just go online, you can check it out.
Mm-hmm.
So what we should do, we do with Chavez and his all his crew.
With, I don't know. You have an idea? What
no,
do we?
I'm not in politics.
Well, doesn't Venezuela produce a lot of oil, and aren't they industrializing their country now?
Yeah. Well, somewhat. Yeah, I guess. Well, what do you want to do? I mean, you know, it's not just to pick on. Venezuela, but they want to destroy the whole world, really. But They would attack any country.
How
whether they have
the point
is
these
you
countries
know,
they're going to nuclear and oil and natural gas and high energy density sources to sustain their populations, and then the Copenhagen summit would mandate that they can only use solar, wind, geothermal, much less energy sources. Their population would collapse. These energy sources can't maintain the populations at the current level. They'll have a massive collapse of population worldwide if all of a sudden these green technologies are mandated and there's zero carbon emissions, like what they want.
How does it limit nuclear power?
Well, nuclear power, like fusion, would be the ultimate power because there is no carbon emissions. But that's not what they're going for. They don't want fusion as part of the green movement. They want solar, they want wind, they want very low energy dense sources.
Although the nuclear fission even didn't have carbon emissions.
Fission doesn't, but it has nasty toxic waste, which we don't need anymore. Now we have viable fusion options. There's no need to.
Well, you have
deuterium, tritium, you have all kinds of different fusion.
What is funny about this, about the fusion or the nuclear overall, is that you had Lord Monckton, who was also. You hold a meeting at the same time as the Copenhagen summit in Copenhagen, but was against it. And to show that it's a big fraud, so he actually asked for a copy of what was being discussed in the Copenhagen summit, and you know he went at it pretty big, so they didn't want to give him the copy at the beginning, and then you know media coverage and all that made so that actually he got a copy, and in the report what they were saying. What they wanted to have nation agree upon is that it's not just enough to go for nuclear energy. Even if they were going to go for nuclear energy, they would actually take that aside. They wouldn't count it. You know, like nuclear energy to decrease your carbon emissions, that's not in their plan. Even though it would do it if you don't want, you know, it's only makes water, you know. So it would decrease carbon emission, but that's not really the point. That's not really what they want. They don't want people to industrialize. They don't want the a big enough energy flux density to maintain populations. So that's, yeah. It was pretty shocking.
And solar panels, and we're going back to an ice age, you're all going to freeze to death.
And it's happening right now. But let me just finish the fourth point of the count for impeachment. So we said conspiracy, crime against humanity, separation of power against the Constitution, and on having an international genocide policy. And the fourth point is conspiracy to destroy the sovereignty of the United States. And that goes now into the question of also these agreements that Obama wanted to sign at the G20 in Pittsburgh and also in London before that, to actually allow the IMF to become basically the international the sovereign kind of bank of the world, where they would issue drawing rights and they would decide the amount of currency for every nation. They would actually monopolize the right on emission of currency. Now Obama was for it. He was for it with Gordon Brown, and he wanted to allow the IMF to get more special drawing rights to revaluate, upgraded. And that's something which the Congress had voted against at a previous meeting. I think it was at the United Nations, but they voted against the Congress, and after that the United Nations, it said the IMF is not going to get more drawing rights, special drawing rights. So Obama, by actually accepting that, by actually, you know, going with the plan, was setting up the United States for destruction. And that's basically the same policy as the bailout. Basically the same idea, to actually destroy your own currency. Hello.
Hey.
By bailing out all these toxic assets. So, okay, so that's another reason why Obama should be impeached. Now, okay, I'll give you this. Okay. So meanwhile, what we were doing also at the same time, as we were saying, okay, Obama needs to be impeached, is we said, well, we have a campaign actually to get people remoralized, get them, you know, optimistic again, because when you see the state of the country, the United States, or the world, you know, it could get somebody to be pretty pessimistic, seeing the leadership, you know, that's coming out of our nations here, especially in the Atlantic region. So we said we're going to run a campaign for Congress, and we're going to get these guys who went for the bailout, went for the destruction of the United States Constitution, and replace them. So we have now three campaigns that are up and running, one in Massachusetts, one in Texas, and another one in California. So we're targeting Barney Bailout Frank. We're targeting NASA, because we want to use it, we don't want to shut it down, in Texas, the Houston region, and we're going against Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House. So these are three youths who joined the LaRouche movement, youth movement, a couple of years ago, and are now running for Congress this year. So that's basically you know, their platform is clearly the LaRouche plan. So they were at the National Press Club Tuesday to launch, you know, in face of the media, their campaign, and say this is what we represent, and that's why we're going to be running this year. So so I wanted to leave it there, and let Matthew go on, but if you have any questions. Take some. No questions?
Well,
I just wanted to show you a video before that.
Okay.
I didn't talk about it, but oh, Matthew, can you?
Yeah.
No.
No?
I'm saying.
How am I doing?
There.
No.
I didn't talk about it, but kind of old news. It's like Christmas news, but no. It's people know now that terrorists are using their underpants to blow up planes. So we just did a video on this.
Actually, just want to make sure that the volume is up. Okay.
Americans, like this.
Oh.
you need the.
Thanks for leaving such a bitter aftertaste in their mouths now for my class. That's great.
Come on, man, I just ate.
I'm sorry.